Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the further capture of towns in Iraq's northwest by ISIL and the Sunni forces fighting with them in an alliance of convenience, and discuss the irony that while Iraq is unraveling, the architects of its destruction, the neocons led by Dick Cheney, are undergoing a revival thanks to the US mainstream media. Mark Danner, who is a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and is the author of The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo, and The Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror, joins us to discuss this anomaly and his recent article at The New York Review of Books, Cheney, The More Ruthless, The Better. Then, with Vladimir Putin announcing that he will conditionally accept Ukraine's offer of a ceasefire while successfully destabilizing eastern Ukraine, we will discuss the extent to which the Western Europeans don't want to impose further sanctions on Putin, who obviously does not want to be subjected to them, and the likelihood that a compromise will be reached on accepting Russia's control of Crimea and influence over Ukraine's eastern provinces. A leading international expert on contemporary Ukrainian and post-communist politics, nationalism, and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies at the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies, Taras Kuzio, joins us to discuss how Russia has won the war but lost the Ukrainian people. Then finally, with the ISIL insurgents bulldozing the berm that marked the 100-year-old Sykes-Picot colonial-drawn border between Syria and Iraq, Scott Anderson, a veteran correspondent who has reported from Lebanon, Israel, and Egypt, and is the author of Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East, joins us to discuss his article at CNN, Why the Middle East's Borders Will Never Be the Same Again, and the Balkanization of Iraq and Libya as we run out of places that the European colonists screwed up. And joining us now is Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist, and professor. Mark Danner was a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and is a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books and teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and Bard College. His books include Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo and the Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. His latest article at The New York Review of Books is Cheney, The More Ruthless, The Better. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Danner.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be here.
And Mark, since you were in Iraq when during the worst period and have written about America's destructive and deadly legacy, which is, of course, continuing to this day, one of the things that you point out in your recent article in the New York Review of Books is a key meeting that took place. I believe it was I'm just looking for the date now. I'm sorry here. Where he met with George Tenet. Bush met with George Tenet in January of 2003 with the invasion of Iraq a few months off. President Bush met with CIA Director George Tenet, and Tenet said he was worried that al-Qaeda could attract more foot soldiers, which apparently Rice and Wolfowitz agreed, and they were concerned that America's efforts had failed to stem the influence of jihadist recruits. And George W. Bush waved his hands dismissively and say, victory will take care of that problem. So
yes.
There's the hubris and the pride before the fall, because it was a quick victory followed by a slow defeat. But what's your sense of why there is no accountability in our history and in our media, as you notice now, I'm sure, that of the irony that I pointed out in the opening, that while Iraq is unraveling, the neocons are being revived?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the most important themes here we see playing out is that there's no memory. There's an American amnesia that really goes back to the war. And the neoconservatives in particular, Cheney, who isn't properly speaking a neoconservative, is riding this wave as well, are trying to take advantage of the fact that people don't necessarily remember. They don't remember specifics. And the narrative that is being advertised and hawked, in a sense, by these people from Wolfowitz to Bremer to Cheney to various others, is that, you know, everything was fine. We won. By the time the Bush administration ended in 2008, it was victory. The surge secured everything. The surge was the victory in the war, which, of course, in 2008 was the advertised storyline. And so this is a rather simple narrative. You know, we won in 2008. Now you wake up again in 2014, and everything's gone to hell. So the obvious conclusion is that Barack Obama is responsible for the disaster, therefore is responsible for any damaging consequences of the decision to go to war on American interests. I mean, it's a ridiculous storyline. It has no basis in fact at all, as many point out. But the fact is that the argument is dependent, really, to be believed, on people not knowing any details of what happened. I mean, not knowing that the final deal for the withdrawal of American forces in 2011 was concluded by George W. Bush, by the Bush administration, in the fall of 2008. So the complete withdrawal of American forces was a decision of the Bush administration, not the Obama administration, even though Obama, of course, agreed with it.
But also Obama, by the way, did try to get the Iraqis to agree to a longer deployment of Americans to train the Iraqi army, and that was vetoed by Maliki under pressure from Iran.
Well, that's quite true, and it's important to point that out. I think another point to make here, though, is that, you know, the numbers they were talking about, even if they had secured an agreement to leave American trainers in the country, the largest numbers they were talking about were 30,000, and the Iraqis were not even close to accepting those numbers. It was finally down to 5,000 or 3,000, and, you know, Maliki said no. And the idea that 5,000 or 3,000 American troops would have made any difference in the current situation is just ridiculous. It's also ridiculous to think that that number of troops would have made sure that American influence remains strong within Iraq, and that the United States, because of these remaining troops, could have forced Maliki to be less secular. This is another somewhat more sophisticated storyline that's running along. And, you know, this is ridiculous. The idea that a handful of troops would have changed the broader political situation within Iraq is just a ridiculous argument to make. But as I say, the argument really depends on people's ignorance about what actually happened. And it's really about, you know, securing the base, basically damaging Obama on foreign policy. Remember, he, you know, during the re-election campaign in 2012, he was very secure when it came to foreign policy. There were really very few attacks on him from the right. The only issue was really Benghazi, and that didn't go anywhere. So, you know, the Republicans are finally trying, using Iraq, to damage him. And a lot of people, of course, are trying to restore, in at least to some degree, their damaged reputations. And that's why you see these people emerging on television programs now and on radio programs. Of course, you know, from the point of view of a lot of bookers on different media outlets, this is good copy. You know, you get Wolfowitz back, people get upset, they argue about it, and so on. So it causes a lot of attention. But the basic storyline is ridiculous, and it's, to anybody who's covered the war, it's vaguely depressing, because you think, well, it doesn't matter what you write or what you report, people don't pay much attention anyway, and they're still able to be convinced by these patently false arguments. You know, I want to go back to the earlier reference you made to the meeting in the White House between the president and George Tenet, President George W. Bush, I mean, when Tenet pointed out to him that the number of recruits as a consequence of Iraq could very well go up, that they were already going up, number of al-Qaeda recruits. And the president said, well, victory will take care of that. And, you know, it wasn't, you said hubris, and I completely agree with that. It was a hubristic statement. But it also showed the total lack of political understanding of what the war would do. There was this belief, certainly within the president himself, that victory would change everything. This overwhelming victory in Iraq would make the jihadists go home, which was just a ridiculous assumption and can only have been held in by someone who was completely ignorant about the Middle East and about the wellsprings of jihadist violence to begin with. I mean, anyone who knew anything about the Middle East could have said that occupying a major Muslim country would be an enormous boon to al-Qaeda, as it was, that, the al-Qaeda franchise would be enormously bolstered by the United States, essentially proving their argument correct. Their argument was that the U.S. was repressing and humiliating all Muslims around the world. And the United States sort of walked into that role, assumed the makeup, assumed the costume, and performed it in front of the entire Muslim world. Osama bin Laden had hoped the U.S. would invade Afghanistan and occupy it. And Iraq was, of course, much, much better because it's much closer to the center it's an Arab country, much closer to the center of Arab concerns. So this really showed the entire lack of understanding at the very top of what the consequences of the Iraq war would be.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Danner, who's a writer, journalist, professor. He's a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books and teaches at the University of California, Berkeley and Bard College. His books include The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo and The Iraq War's Buried History and Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib and The War on Terror. And his latest article at The New York Review of Books is Cheney, The More Ruthless, The Better. But obviously, Iraq was, a huge boon to bin Laden. He didn't expect to be gifted that in such a way. And of course, the great irony now is that it is the hotbed of al-Qaeda, in effect, with this group ISIL. Clearly, they're working with the Sunnis. But I'm wondering, the extent to which, to some extent, our loyal opposition is to blame for not having an inquiry into the origins of the Iraq War, as the British did. How many times have the Republicans had these bogus investigations into Benghazi, where only four people died, as opposed to 4,480 Iraq, along with enormous numbers, 32,000 wounded, hundreds of thousands with psychological wounds, and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis in the country torn apart and millions displaced. In your article at the New York Review of Books, Cheney, The More Ruthless, The Better, you talk about what happened on 9/11 and Cheney's bogus claims of ordering the shoot down of the plane that had already crashed in Pennsylvania. Lawrence Wilkerson, who is Colin Powell's chief of staff, told me that at that moment, nobody could find Cheney and Rumsfeld. They both went AWOL. The theory is, at least Wilkerson's theory is, that they were just terrified that the American people would rise up and hold them accountable for the reckless endangerment of the United States. And thanks to the idiocy of the fecklessness of the Democrats and the idiocy of the 9/11 truthers who dignify Bush and Cheney by suggesting they were part of some bizarre plot, when in fact they were the most incompetent stewards of American national security, we have the results that we have.
Well, I certainly agree that what would have been very welcome is a comprehensive inquiry into the wellspring, into the start of the Iraq war, what was known, the intelligence, what led up to the actual war itself. I think that would have been very welcome, and it would have clarified the political situation in a way that would be very salutary. The main problem with doing that, of course, when you talk about a loyal opposition, the main difficulty was that so many Democrats, so many leading Democrats, were in favor of the war. That was, unfortunately, in 2002 and 2003, thought to be the smart vote. The smart vote was for the war. Anyone who was serious about presidential ambitions on the Democratic side voted for the war. And, of course, we can bring the phrase loyal opposition into the media and press and intellectual world as well. Frank Rich has a superb article in New York Magazine about the, you know, liberal hawks, as they were called. You know, so many people I knew and respected on the liberal side were very much in favor of the Iraq war. It was kind of the creative, the leaning forward position to be for the war. So the, one of the problems with an inquiry is that it implicates a lot of people on the liberal side, both in the political elite and in the intellectual elite. And I think that's one of the reasons why we never had one. And it means that to this day, you have people, when you start talking about Iraq, who have been compromised by their earlier positions. It's not a black and white Republican-Democratic split at all. I think finally that the events of 9/11, you know, the day itself are fascinating. I know that Rumsfeld went down to the parking lot after the Pentagon was struck by the airliner, and he was unreachable during this time when the Situation Room people in the White House were desperately trying to figure out how many planes there were and whether they were going to be attacked again and so on. And Rumsfeld, although I suppose one can say, well, it's admirable to want to help things on the ground, he didn't really do his job, which was to be Secretary of Defense in the chain of command. Cheney was in the bunker beneath the White House. And as I try to point out in the article in the New York Review, though he seems still to be claiming that he ordered the Pennsylvania plane to be shot down. In fact, he didn't issue the order until after the plane had crashed. And it's quite clear, it's a fairly simple timeline, that if that plane hadn't been downed by the pilots themselves and the passengers, that it would have hit its target, whether it was the Capitol or the White House. So there's a real myth that they would have shot it down, which it just simply isn't true.
So, Mark Denner, back to the irony that while Iraq is unraveling, the neocons are being rehabilitated in the press. Although I must say that even on Fox News, Dick Cheney was challenged because he's now claiming that, because the obvious questions to ask is, well, you know, you said that al-Qaeda was in Iraq, and that's why, one of the reasons that we went in there along with the mythical WMD, and it turned out that they weren't in Iraq, but now al-Qaeda seems to be taking over Iraq, or at least a similar organization, and to which Cheney's now blaming the predecessors, the Clinton administration. So it's a pretty extraordinary how little Cheney has been taken on and how insular he is against or immune to reality. Do you think that it'll ever happen, or is he just in his own world? Because one of the things I find extraordinary is, and again, there's not much publicity about it, is that Bush no longer talks to Cheney, basically since they got out of office. Bush finally, I guess, came to the conclusion that Cheney stole his presidency out from under him.
I think that it's certainly true that, I mean, all the accounts, the reliable accounts of those 8 years attest to the fact that the vice president was very influential, beyond influential, the most powerful vice president in history, certainly, in the first 4 years, but that influence waned considerably in the second term as he remained very, very hawkish. He wanted to attack Iran. He wanted to attack Syria. And increasingly with these positions, he was marginalized. This was accelerated by the move of Condoleezza Rice to the State Department and also by the arrival of Robert Gates as Secretary of Defense. Both of them really worked against these kind of extreme hawkish tendencies of Cheney. And I think there's also, when it comes to the personal relationship, a continuing anger, it seems, on the part of Cheney when it comes to Bush's failure to pardon Scooter Libby, his chief of staff. And that seems to be a wound that apparently has not healed. But, you know, it's fascinating. Cheney has been as successful a politician as he's been, and he has, of course, been very successful, in part because he never, ever, ever looks back. He never admits he's wrong. He is relentless in taking and holding to extreme right-wing positions. And he is, you know, if you look at his memoir, which I did and reviewed in the New York Review of Books, you see that there's almost no reflection. There's no, let alone any tendency to say, well, that was a decision that was questionable, or I wish I could do that again. On the contrary, everything was correct. Everything was done the way it should have been done. There were no faults. There were no mistakes. He is relentless in this regard. And that current piece in the Wall Street Journal, which he wrote with his daughter, Liz, should be read, I think, by everybody as a demonstration of this kind of relentless attitude, you know, absolute refusal to take on any facts that do not agree with his ideological view. I mean, he has a line in there that, you know, about Obama, that no president has been wrong about so much at the expense of so many. And you look at that and think, my God, that describes George W. Bush. I mean, it really does, you know, when it comes to the Iraq War in particular. But Katrina, 9/11 itself, I mean, various other things, you know, the national economy, it was a disastrous presidency. And you think, what kind of hubris is there writing this about his successor? But by all accounts, Cheney does believe it. And he's been very successful in essentially never flinching. He does not flinch. He does not look back. He does not change his mind. He holds to these points of views, and he is relentless about it.
Well, maybe St. Peter will have an argument with him, assuming he goes to heaven, which is highly unlikely given the death and destruction he has wrought. I thank you for joining me.
St. Peter will not make any progress with him, is my prediction.
Thank you for joining us, Mark Danner.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Danner, who's a writer, journalist, and professor. He's also a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to The New Yorker Review of Books. And he teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and Bard College. And his books include Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo and the Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. And his latest article at The New Yorker Review of Books is Cheney, The More Ruthless, The Better. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about how Putin appears to have won in Ukraine.
Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Taras Kuzio, a leading international expert on contemporary Ukrainian and post-communist politics, nationalism, and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute for Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. He is a fellow with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the School for Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and his latest book is Commissars into Oligarchs, A Contemporary History of Ukraine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Taras Kuzio.
Hi.
And it looks as though Russian President Putin is playing good cop, bad cop. He's clearly sending armored vehicles, and his GRU are in eastern Ukraine, working obviously in concert with the so-called secessionists. And, you know, they've shot down an airliner full of Ukrainian paratroopers, etc. They did that with Stinger-type missiles. You can't get those things off the shelf. So there's clearly a lot of collusion going on. At the same time, he's exploring the diplomatic track, and now he has agreed to the ceasefire, at least a qualified agreement to the ceasefire put forth by President Petro Poroshenko. So I suppose the good news is that Putin doesn't need to invade eastern Ukraine. He's already destabilized it.
Well, he's undertaking a proxy war in two of the eight Russian-speaking regions of eastern Ukraine. He hoped it would be throughout the region. That hasn't happened. It's only really taken off in two of them, which are also the home base of the Party of Regions, which is the party of the outgoing president, Yanukovych. So there's not a coincidence there as well. So it's a combined operation of former Yanukovych supporters plus Russia externally. It's what's going on at the moment suits both Russia and the West, who are part of the game. And the game is that Russia is pretending not to invade, and the West is pretending Russia's not invading. And that permits the West to not move to a more extensive and deeper range of sanctions against Russia, and it permits Russia not to have those sanctions. When, in fact, everybody knows, as you rightly said, that this high-tech equipment, tanks, armored personnel carriers, surface-to-air missiles, Grad rocket launchers, all of this is not the usual military kit for terrorists. I mean, the IRA in Northern Ireland over a 30-year period did not have this kind of equipment, because it wasn't supplied to them by an external power, namely Ireland. So this has obviously been brought in, and it's and the West is really preferring this scenario to a full-scale Russian invasion, because a Russian invasion is more clear-cut, and they would have to impose tougher sanctions. So this is a sort of a game, a kind of a phony war that the West is involved in, because try as even President Obama, who's not exactly very strong on the international stage, try as much as he can President Obama, it's the Europeans who are the weak link here on sanctions.
And what do you think is the significance then of the June 27th, which is, of course, next week, signing, which the new Ukrainian president said he will sign the deal with Europe, which began this whole unraveling and this crisis between the Ukraine and Russia.
It's the second part of a very extensive agreement. The political side, the association agreement, was signed in March, pretty much quickly after regime change, when Yanukovych fled Ukraine. And that was obviously done for political purposes to anchor Ukraine in. This isn't what's called the Deep and Comprehensive Free Trade Agreement. It's important in that it opens up the biggest market in the world, the European Union, to Ukrainian goods. Two other countries are going to be following suit, maybe at the same time. I don't know if it's next week, Georgia and Moldova. So what it means for these countries, including Ukraine, is that they're no longer on the crossroads. They're no longer in the gray zone, as it were. They've anchored themselves into European integration. Now, from the viewpoint of Vladimir Putin, he would very much have liked to have stopped this. This is what happened back in November. If we recall, Viktor Yanukovych turned away from this agreement and moved towards Russia. This led to the Euromaidan revolution, and the rest is history. But the I don't see, no matter what really Vladimir Putin does today, he's not going to stop this process, because Ukraine's already signed one part of the agreement in March, and nothing will stop Ukraine signing it on next Friday, this coming Friday. So I think this is just an attempt to destabilize. It's revenge. It's Putin sort of letting leash his anger. Somebody who should definitely go on an anger management course. And he does know, though, so this sort of the destabilization in Ukraine won't really affect European integration, except that it will detract from the ability of the new authorities to focus exclusively on the reforms which are required by the IMF agreement signed by Ukraine and by this EU agreement. So in that sense, it prevents, to some degree, full focus by the Ukrainians, and therefore Putin doesn't really want a success story on his border because that's potential for contagion into Russia itself, where the Russians might say, well, maybe that system's better than ours. But it does affect NATO, because, of course, a country cannot join NATO if it has this kind of conflict on its territory, because NATO wouldn't want to bring a conflict into the organization. And this is at a time where support for NATO membership in Ukraine is going through the roof. In the highest it ever was sort of in the second half of the 90s, and then it was about 33% in Ukraine. Today, support for membership is 48%, which is very high. There were many NATO prospective members, such as Slovenia, Hungary, Latvia, where support for membership never really got much above 50% when they joined a decade ago. So Ukraine is going up that way, and it's not surprising. People who were on the fence before, people who had illusions about Russia and such like, have all changed their mind. So Putin can stop that, but I think the main crux of this problem as well is that although Petro Poroshenko, the president, has introduced a unilateral ceasefire for a week in an attempt to negotiate, there's very little I can see that he can negotiate with President Putin, because the kind of things that Poroshenko would have to do to satisfy Putin are simply not on the table. For example, halting European integration or introducing some kind of federal system. Neither of these will ever be supported by Poroshenko. So it makes me quite pessimistic that any kind of negotiated breakthrough will happen. Putin will not be able to stop Ukraine, as it were, moving west. He's lost, I wrote back in March, he's gained Crimea, but he's lost Ukraine.
Again, I'm speaking with Taras Kuzios, a leading international expert on contemporary Ukrainian and post-communist politics, nationalism and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. He is a fellow with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and his latest book is Commissars into Oligarchs, A Contemporary History of Ukraine. So what is, in terms of Putin's qualified support for this ceasefire between the secessionists in eastern Ukraine and the Ukrainian the Ukrainian government under a new president, Petro Poroshenko? Putin is saying that Kiev must negotiate and make compromise with pro-Russian rebels for the plan to be viable and realistic. And then Putin said, but the ceasefire must not be used as an ultimatum. What do you think he means by that?
Well, he wants to introduce the separatist terrorists, however you want to call them, as an actor into the negotiating process. So in other words, until now, we've had negotiations really between three sides, the EU, Russia, and Ukraine. What Putin would love to have is a four-sided negotiation where the separatists would also be at the table. And that's something the Ukrainians and really any government wouldn't agree with. But the other problem that is related to this is that there isn't one leader of these groups. There isn't one, as it were, Che Guevara. These groups are very disparate. They're very divided amongst themselves. Some are beholden to Russia. Some are just gangs of criminals who are out to make money and to loot. So even if Ukraine agreed to allow them to come to the table as a negotiating partner, it's not clear who they would send and who would be able to represent all of them. Because there's no question that Russia is continuing and began to heavily support them in sort of late March, April and May. But as with always with these kind of conflicts, they've grown out of proportion to what the initial investment was. And I doubt whether even Vladimir Putin could turn off all the taps today. So it's more he thinks that they should sit at the negotiating tables and be in a position to issue their demands to the Ukrainians, which I am pretty sure that President Poroshenko will never agree to. And anyway, firstly, they don't have a single leader, and more importantly as well, they don't have majority support in those regions because the referendum in May was a joke. And what you have, in effect, is a silent majority. So, opinion polls give the separatists only something like 25% support.
Well, as you pointed out, a lot of them are just simple criminals and thugs. But what about the economic pressure that Putin is putting on Ukraine? They banned the importation of Ukrainian potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they're demanding payment for the gas, and they've cut off the spigot. And Ukraine's economy has tanked. It's obviously been looted by the previous regime. And so at this point, surely, I mean, I've understand that Poroshenko has always had reasonably good relations with Russia and with the Kremlin, even though previously at one point they banned the importation of his chocolates. He's known as the Chocolate King under some trumped-up charge. So, you know, how much more pressure can Russia exert if indeed, you know, this is, I mean, they've got a lot of levers, haven't they? That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, they have, but on the energy side, it was always a question that, which is the biggest lever. On the energy side, the Ukrainians never used their lever, which is as powerful as Russia's. Russia does the supplying, but the Ukrainians control the pipelines that export 60% of Russian gas. And let's recall that so Russia is just basically a Nigeria with nuclear weapons. I mean, it's just a raw material exporting country, and therefore it's heavily reliant on the export of carbons. So the Ukrainians never used the pipelines as a counter-pressure because the Ukrainian leaders were heavily themselves involved in energy corruption. So there was a kind of a common alliance between corrupt leaders on both sides of the border. Today, that's not the case. Today, they are standing up and using their potential power of controlling the pipelines and making themselves have a leverage over Russia. So it's not as clear-cut as it was in the past. And sympathy is in the West is heavily on the Ukrainian side in this energy dispute because it's ludicrous that Russia is demanding that Ukraine, which borders Russia, pay the highest gas price in Europe. I mean, it's ludicrous that Ukraine would be willing to import cheaper Russian gas from Germany, Slovakia, and Hungary. So this is everybody understands this is a political question. So it's at the moment it's not a crisis because it's a summer. There's very little gas being used. But approaching winter, if this continues, it certainly will be. There's also the other aspect of this is that Russia is going to lose a lot of international court cases, including in Stockholm and elsewhere. Firstly, over this unwillingness to compromise over the 2009 gas contract and misabusing its monopoly status, but more importantly, over all the assets it's stolen in the Crimea, including gas and oil. The leverage, Russia does have some leverage, but it's not as clear cut on Russia's side as it maybe used to be.
So, but what about this just in the broader sense? I was speaking recently with the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, and he made the argument that, you know, that at some point or other, Ukraine's got to learn to live with Russia just as Mexicans have to learn to live with the United States being next to a superpower. Do you accept that logic?
Well, of course you have to get on with your neighbors. As we know, in many countries in Europe, this takes a long time. Sometimes in the case of France and Germany, it took two world wars. And it also takes different types of leaders. I don't see how some kind of reconciliation between Ukraine and Russia can happen whilst Putin's in power, and he's not intending to leave power soon. It's going to be extremely difficult, and the majority of Ukrainians have never really held anti-Russian viewpoints. They tend to be only in the west of the country. So in many senses, this stoking up of conflict is artificial, and it's being undertaken from the Russian side, not from the Ukrainian.
And you say it's backfired in a sense that the Ukrainian people...
Well, it's backfired because it's increased support for NATO and it's forced many particular East Ukrainians to reevaluate their views on Russia. And what's happened is that the previous romanticism of Russia, which was linked to the Soviet Union in some ways, has evaporated. And so the pro-Russian lobby or pro-Russian camp in Ukrainian politics and economics is now in massive crisis, particularly because the two regions of the country which were the most pro-Russian and most kind of neo-Soviet in their national identity were the Crimea and Donetsk. So, you know, Vladimir Putin has done a great job in both solidifying Ukraine's national identity and in severely damaging and probably irrevocably damaging the pro-Russian identity, pro-Russian lobby group in Ukraine. And from that point of view, he's actually undermined his own strategy and policies. But this wouldn't be the first time that Russia's done that. Russia does this all the time. In the 1990s, Leni Kuchma was elected in 1994 on a relatively benign pro-Russian platform. It took Russia 3 to 4 years to recognize Ukraine's borders. Kuchma got very fed up with Russia, and this was Boris Yeltsin, not Putin. He got very fed up with Russia, so he turned to the United States and NATO. And so Russia does this all the time. It's very good at making potential friends and allies into enemies.
So just in closing, though, it does seem that Petro Poroshenko, the new Ukrainian president, is walking on eggshells to some extent. He fired his foreign minister, who made some very off-color remark about Putin. I don't recall. What did he say, the foreign minister, that's just been fired?
Well, it began as a football chant in Ukraine, which then became highly popular on the internet and YouTube and elsewhere. And it's basically a chant which says Putin is a dickhead, but it's actually far stronger than that, not really for the radio.
Well, nevertheless, the new president fired his foreign minister, obviously as a gesture to Putin. So,
well, it's more a question that he was building up. I mean, I think that might have been the excuse he used, but Poroshenko, under the parliamentary constitution, really only has influence over national security issues, because the government does economics, parliament, politics. So he used that maybe as the excuse to, in effect, build up his own team. And in the course of 1 week, he put his own people in charge of the National Bank, foreign policy, and elsewhere. So because the people that were in place were kind of acting foreign ministers or acting defense ministers from... who came in just after the regime change in February. He's walking on eggshells, yes, because one of his main planks of why he was elected in the first round, which is unusual in Ukraine, usually it's a two-round contest, was that he promised to end the crisis and the conflict in East Ukraine very quickly. And that's, I don't think that's going to be very likely. I think the Ukrainian forces are making advances. They're more professional now. They're better trained. They're getting some combat experience. So I think they are shifting the balance in their favor. So and that will mean that maybe the with the greater defeat of these terrorists, that what we're going to move from is insurgency to terrorism. Because, I mean, when you have 10 to 20,000 people with arms, this is not really terrorism anymore. It's more insurgency. But I think that will be sufficiently suppressed to move it to a stage of a few hundred, maybe, terrorists down the road. But it's still going to be a crisis and conflict that's going to last a long time. After all, the British Army, one of the best in the world, took decades to defeat the IRA. But that would be inevitably an improvement. But Poroshenko is under eggshells because he promised to end the conflict, and he's also hasn't got much leverage because he's reliant on Western aid. And the Ukrainian public, because of the failures of the past, do not trust their politicians, and therefore they're watching every move he makes. So he is walking on eggshells.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Taras Kuzio.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Taras Kuzio, who's a leading international expert on contemporary Ukrainian and post-communist politics, nationalism, and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies at the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. He is also a fellow with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And his latest book is Commissars into Oligarchs, A Contemporary History of Ukraine. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about why the Middle East borders will never be the same. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Anderson, a veteran war correspondent who has reported from Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, and many other strife-torn countries, a frequent contributor to the New York Times magazine. His work has also appeared in Vanity Fair and Esquire, and his latest book is Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East, now out in paperback. And he has an article at CNN, Why the Middle East's Borders Will Never Be the Same Again. Welcome to Background Briefing. Scott Anderson.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure to be here.
And as the ISIL or ISIS insurgents bulldoze the berm that it was the Sykes-Picot colonial drawn border between Syria and Lebanon, that feels somewhat symbolic, is it not? But it's more than that, isn't it? That in effect, they're ratifying the truth on the ground.
Well, I think that's exactly right. Of course, it's symbolic, but this has been their stated goal all along, is to redraw those borders that were imposed almost exactly a century ago at the end of World War I.
So, what's your sense then of what? Well, let's just go around the region. What are the cohesive regimes or countries that have national identity? And what are the ones in flux?
Right. Well, certainly Egypt, with this, whatever its other problems, it does have a national identity going back probably 4,000 years and a rather established border. Beyond that, and of course, you have Israel, which is an armed camp. But beyond that, almost everything is in flux. I think that the one place that so far is kind of a mystery is Jordan, which has been, it's the one country that really was completely cut out of whole cloth by the British at the end of World War One, and yet it's thus far maintains a certain stability, certainly a much greater stability than in Syria or Iraq. So I think with those exceptions, almost the entire region, and then in North Africa, is also in flux.
Well, Libya is disintegrating into a balkanization, is it not? Basically, three groups, I think, from my understanding.
That's right. It's Libya today is essentially three countries, and the irony is, and it's, you're seeing the same thing in Iraq. Iraq is increasingly becoming three countries, and in both those places, it matches up very closely to the semi-autonomous provinces that existed under the Ottomans. So, in this interesting way, I think you're seeing a reversion to those Ottoman borders that the British and French carved up and dismantled.
Well, of course, the British and French colonial era ended with its death rattle with the attack on the Suez Canal. I think it was at, 1956. Right. And, of course, what historians seem to continually forget is that that happened at the very moment that the Hungarian Revolution was underway. And years ago, I spoke with the CIA station chief in Budapest at the time, Arthur Macy Cox, who, along with his Russian counterpart, Yuri Andropov, who later became the leader of the Soviet Union, they worked out a deal to basically for the Russians to, you know, essentially allow a reformist government in Hungary, which would have been somewhat along the lines of Yugoslavia. And then as soon as the British and the French attacked the Suez, the Russians reneged on the deal and slaughtered the very guys that they were negotiating with. Thanks a lot, British colonists. You really, that was a double whammy, you know. By the way, Israel joined in that attack on Egypt, too, I might add.
That's right. That's right. They went into the Sinai. The reverberations of that whole era in the Middle East echo far beyond the region, and of course we're continuing to see the fallout of all that today.
So, what's your sense then of where this situation in Iraq that's unraveling? And earlier we spoke with Mark Denner about the irony that just as Iraq is unraveling, the architects of its destruction, the neocons, are being revived, at least in the press.
I know it's a pretty kind of a when I heard what Dick Cheney said the other day, it was rather jaw-dropping, the audacity of someone who is the architect of all this still thinks they somehow got it right. I think clearly what's Kurdistan, Iraqi Kurdistan is now out the door, and they have been for quite a long time. They're not. I don't see any reason why Iraqi Kurdistan is going to formally break away, formally secede from Iraq. They don't need to. They have the oil. They have their own military. They have their own foreign policy, and in a way, they have their own protector. And again, talk about irony. Their protector being the Republic of Turkey, and certainly that protective status would disappear in a hurry if Iraqi Kurdistan declared independence, because Turkey certainly does not want an independent Kurdistan on its border. As I've been looking at this crisis unfolding in Iraq, I can actually foresee a situation coming where Maliki, there seems to be a consensus that Maliki has to go. But if Maliki doesn't go from Iraq, I can see that it might be in his interest and the Shiite hardliners around him to actually let the Sunni center under ISIS or ISIL essentially break away and join with eastern Syria. There's clearly been. I was just in Jordan and Turkey last month, and everybody in the region talks about how it's very clear that there was a deal cut between Bashar al-Assad with ISIS. For the past 4 or 5 months, ISIS has all of their fighting has been against the other Syrian rebels. And until just a few days ago, they were never attacked by the Syrian government. So everybody points to there was some deal was cut. So and along with this, it's known that the Assad regime has a blueprint that if things continue on or things get worse, that they may break away and create their own sort of mini Syria in western Syria, leaving the east to stew in its own juices. And the Iraqi government may reach the same point where they decide to let their west go. So I think that that's becoming a more and more plausible scenario by the day.
Well, of course, the really grim part of this is that if ISIS or ISIL make more gains, they've just captured another town. I don't know. I think I had a Sunni on the other day who I think was a Baathist who had all kinds of grandiose ideas about how they were going to take back the country, even Basra.
Right.
But they're clearly emboldened now, and I think it's a misnomer to call this whole thing in Iraq an insurgency of ISIL. Clearly, the Sunnis are completely involved, and Unfortunately, the Shiite militias are surrounding the last Sunni areas of Baghdad. Obviously, they're going to slaughter those people if things get bad. So it could get really ugly. But at the end of the day, I don't see this. You're putting Humpty Dumpty back together again, do you?
No, I see no way of it ever being put back together. And of course, this is. You know, this is precisely what ISIS wants. Executing and then posting the pictures of executing the soldiers last weekend, and then sending these incendiary things that they're going to destroy Karbala and Najaf, which are the Shia holy cities. I think this has just been a very cold-blooded, very cynical idea. They know they can't. They know they're not going to reach Karbala and Najaf, and what they're by saying they're going to do that and to destroy these holy sites. What they want is they want the Iranians to come in on the side of the Maliki regime, which has happened. They want this country to be polarized. So, you know, you mentioned somebody, a Sunni coming on saying that they're going to go all the way to Basra. The brains behind ISIS have, you know, there's no way they're ever going to get to Basra. What they want is to divide the country. And if the result of that is thousands or certainly hundreds of innocent Sunnis in Baghdad being slaughtered by the Shia militias, That suits them just fine. It's a really cynical, just cold-blooded calculus that they're doing.
So, Scott Anderson, what do you make of the Supreme Leader in Iran saying he doesn't want the Americans in there? That's pretty much Obama's position, right?
Yeah. The politics of this get just so crazy, this idea. I actually think the role now of the Americans is going to be a very limited one. I think that the Obama administration is looking at basically the Iranians sort of coming to the defense of the Maliki regime. And I think that's probably the way it's going to play out. Certainly, the Obama administration would love to stay out as much as possible. But they also don't want to see, southern Iraq has been essentially an Iraqi satellite, an Iranian satellite state for the past 7-8 years anyway. What they don't want to see is where that becomes, where the de facto status becomes an official one. So I think it's down to almost a face-saving situation at this point.
But surely the lessons of recent history of our misadventures in the Middle East indicate that once the U.S. puts boots on the ground in a Muslim country, they become the issue. The countries themselves forget about what their problems are, and the U.S. becomes the problem. And that would happen if the U.S. intervened in Iraq again.
That's right. I think this was the dilemma that was facing the administration, even with Syria, of not even putting boots on the ground, but to the degree that you choose sides in a conflict, you start arming and training them. People were saying, well, why don't they do more for the Free Syrian Army? And the problem is, that given America's reputation in the region, as soon as you overtly back one side, that side starts to be seen as the lackeys and the stooges of the Americans. So there's very limited maneuvering room for the administration anywhere.
Well, Scott Anderson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Anderson, who's a veteran war correspondent who has reported from Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, and many other strife-torn countries. He's a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine, and his work has also appeared in Vanity Fair and Esquire. And his latest book is Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Middle East, now out in paperback. And he has an article at CNN, Why the Middle East's Borders Will Never Be the Same Again. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.